Island.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Rest is Entertainment with me, Marina Hyde.
And me, Richard Osman. Hello, Marina.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm all right. Now, we're not doing a Q&A this week. We've been set quite a fun challenge, which is the biggest ever comebacks. I think you're going to do TV and film. I'm going to do music. I'm going to do books and I'm going to do comedy.
Can we just get on to the fact of, okay, if you're talking about a comeback, what is a comeback?
Yeah.
In my view, you have to have fallen out of the public taste for one reason or another. I mean, I guess it could be scandal.
Yeah.
Or it could just be a matter of everybody's moved on from you. Indifference.
Yeah.
The greatest enemy in showbiz.
Yeah.
And then somehow you come back. There's a couple of I've put in mind, which I probably will then say,
yeah.
Oh no, actually, I think they just used to be cult heroes and then they became mainstream.
I'm just looking through mine, I think, because I wasn't aware that you were going to be the person defining all the terms. I think it'll be okay, but we will absolutely keep an
eye
on it.
You're welcome to argue with me. I think you know that by now.
Well, do you know what? That's not a bad idea. I should start doing that.
Okay, what should we start with?
Biggest ever movie comebacks?
Yeah.
Biggest ever actor comebacks?
Okay, well, I'll talk about... You're not going to love this. I'm going to talk about actors, but then I want to talk about a genre as well.
Why am I not going to love that?
Well, maybe you will, because but you'll see that it doesn't quite fit in either category, but okay.
Oh my God, that I don't like.
In terms of biggest ever, I would say... I know lots of people think it was John Travolta, because Travolta was a sort of, you know, big star, and he had Grease and Saturday Night Fever and all of those sort of things. And then suddenly he has this like abysmal 80s and he's a nothing. He's a zero.
Look Who's Talking type things. He was the first name that came to
mind. I mean, those were at least
mind.
Hits.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some other really, you know, nothing happens at all, and he's almost on TV movies. And then Quentin Tarantino kind of rescues him from taboo and puts him in Pulp Fiction, which has a number of taboos in it. And then he becomes sort of cool again. So I get it. It would probably be in my top three.
I will say rather than that. He was going to be in my top three. I'm not doing a top three for movies because I know you're in charge of that.
Nicolas Cage. I feel like Nicolas Cage, you know, because he's become quite ironist and he's become a person who's like ironic about being Nicolas Cage now. I went back and I was thinking of the early stuff. I mean, if you're telling me he doesn't get the joke of Nicolas Cage, which I've always felt was his USP as an actor, he does even in like Raising Arizona. He certainly does in Moonstruck. So, and I mean, that's going back to the
80s. And I'm not sure he had a super fallow period, did he?
Nicolas Cage. I don't think he
not
really did.
Not fallow enough.
Mickey Rourke and Brendan Fraser, I'm sort of bracketing together because they both did that thing where like they have completely fallen away from the public mood. And then Brendan Fraser gets extremely fat and wears a fat suit for a role for The Whale. And Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler gets like stapled and stuff with the staple gun. But it didn't last. So they do have this amazing comeback and everyone's like, oh, they're on the awards circuit. And they're nominated and in some cases win various awards.
Yeah.
But then you're not like, oh, what's Brendan Fraser doing now? It's like, yeah, no, I think he did the comeback and then he's gone. So
what is Brendan Fraser doing now?
I don't know. Yeah. Kei Hai Quan, who was short round in
that's
Indiana Jones.
Really
I know,
good
that's
one.
A lovely story because he eventually sort of basically leaves Hollywood because he thinks there are just no roles for Asian actors. And then suddenly like Crazy Rich Asians happened and he thinks, oh, hang on. I mean, I guess there is a vibe out there. And it's in fact, Jeff Cohen, who's one of his Goonies co-stars, says, really pushes him for Everything Everywhere All at Once. And he comes back into Hollywood and he wins an Oscar.
Yes, that's a great comeback.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that at all.
So
that's
I think
great.
I'm having him
Beat
as
that.
My three.
Oh, he's number three. Okay.
We don't have to do top threes of all of them. But number two, I know everyone thinks Robert Downey Jr. because obviously he had this great career and then he kind of threw it all away.
If he's not your number one, I am already fascinated.
You're going to be so annoyed who my number one is.
Oh, no, really?
It means, well, I don't want you to be because she's amazing. And a complete monster. Robert Downey Jr., he has this kind of complete, he falls apart with drugs and anyway, he comes back and he has to be drug tested every day. Anyway, as we know, it goes on to become the greatest ever run of massive hits in Hollywood history. So he's my number two. Number one, going back into Hollywood's past, is Joan Crawford. Now, let me tell you the story of Joan Crawford. Joan Crawford was a star at MGM. MGM was the prestige studio. It was beautiful. Everyone, it was the most glamorous. When she was at her peak, there were like three megastars, and it was her, Greta Garbo, and Norma Shearer. She's huge. But then...
Which is now the lineup of The Rest is Football.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. God, I wonder which one she'd be. Not Gary. She becomes absolutely huge. But then she then starts... her film stopped making money, and she is the person described as box office poison. So she becomes that thing. She finally sort of basically is allowed to leave because they don't even want her anymore, because stars back then were contracted then. It was really important. You couldn't do anything else. You had to work for a studio and that was it. And she's not getting any good parts. She goes to Warner Brothers, and which were a much more scrappy studio, not in the top tier, but she, through absolute force of will, she is an incredible force of nature, like I said, complete monster, but she stars in Mildred Pierce and she gets the Best Actress Oscar. So that is amazing. But then it all falls away again. And over the whole of the, you know, most of the 50s, she can't get arrested. And then she comes back in 1962.
She's done a double comeback.
Yeah. That's why I'm putting her in, with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, with her and Bette Davis. And that from then on, she passes into the, and she becomes an sort of iconic scream queen, because she goes into sort of horror and thriller and things like that. And also, women got written off in such an extreme way in that era, more even than now, by a long way. And through sheer force of will, and, you know, force of nature can be a euphemism, and certainly was in Joan Crawford's case, she pushes her way all the way back. So I think for me, she is the ultimate comeback machine in movies. Right, but I've got to say one more thing, because a genre, the Western. The Western was the biggest thing ever in America, movies as we know, for how long. And then the great thing they always say about Heaven's Gate, Michael Cimino's like legendary flop, is that it kind of murdered three things. It murdered the idea of the new Hollywood, all these directors being given kind of infinite powers. It murdered a studio, United Artists, which actually is collapsed by it. And it murdered the Western genre, like no one's going to make a Western after that. Not entirely true, because you do get certain ones, and you get things like, I don't know, Unforgiven or Young Guns or like The Hateful Eight, and things come back. But you never really think this genre is kind of had its day. And yet, what are all Taylor Sheridan shows, if not Westerns? They're, and it's a really big sense of itself, part of its sense of its itself, that bit of America, the kind of Western ideals. So you've got Yellowstone, which is obviously explicitly, basically a Western. But even shows like, you know, Landman, it's a kind of frontier land shows. It's a place where normal rules don't really apply. Even like Tulsa King, where it's set in a city, it's really very much a new sheriff's in town. And it, so I think that idea that like Westerns were dead, Westerns have never been big. They are the biggest shows on TV.
The Western sensibility.
Yeah. But via Taylor Sheridan, I think that I would say that they're all, I mean, I think Landman is a Western. So I would say that genre that really seemed dead is not dead at all.
Okay.
Okay.
Shall we move on to comeback singles?
Oh,
which
yes.
I always think is interesting. The album stuff, I think it's boring, but like a comeback single that rescues an act from kind of from despair, because that's what can happen with music. You just release an absolute banger and everyone goes, everything else is forgiven and forgotten. It's the great thing about music, is you can just do in 3 minutes.
3 minutes, yeah.
You can absolutely transform your career. I'll do a top three as well. My top two I've absolutely got in order. My third one, it's slightly trickier. I've gone with UK ones, really, because that's, I find that much more interesting. And the three I've gone for, I remember early 90s, Blur had turned up and had done There's No Other Way and had sort of like a baggy dance top 10 hit.
Yeah.
And suddenly there were all these guitar bands and Blur were absolutely in the dumper. They'd had two or three singles that went to kind of number 34 or something like that. And they looked like they were going to be the also-rans of the Britpop movement. There's all these other bands starting up at the same time, and you think, oh, those chances from Chelmsford, who did that sort of slight indie dance tune, they're they're disappearing. Then I went to see them at the Town and Country Club. Don't go looking for it; it's not there. In Kentish Town, and they played Girls and Boys, and you were like, whoa!
What is the gap between that and There's No Other Way?
I mean, not long. I mean,
but it seems like forever, because they had so disappeared. Yeah,
yeah. But you know, they had, as all bands do at the start of their career, you know, look at Radiohead with Anyone Can Play Guitar. You know, you're thinking, what do we need to do? How do we have a hit? How do we become successful? They do that very quickly. And then a smart band like Radiohead or Blur goes, no, actually, who are we? What is it that we do? So they go away. They wrote the suite of songs that became Park Life. Girls and Boys comes out, gets to number 5. A year later is Blur versus Oasis, and Blur are one of the two biggest bands in the country. But anyone who goes back and remembers that time, Blur were absolutely, they'd been written off.
Yeah.
And they came back because, well, firstly, they had that song Girls and Boys, which absolutely reintroduced them to people. And then the Park Life album blew everybody away. But so I was thinking about them for number 3. But then I was also thinking about Duran Duran. who really had absolutely disappeared from the scene. You know, Duran Duran fans still love them, but they were seen as a, you know, a band from the 80s, and they were seen as pretty boys and all that type of stuff. They then decide, you know what? Forget studios, forget expensive producers. We are going to go and sit in someone's living room and record some songs. And they came back with, I think it's the greatest comeback single of all time, Ordinary World.
Yeah.
And even to this day, weirdly, with all their hits, it always tops the polls of Duran Duran fans' favourite songs.
Because it's about being in the wilderness and so, you know, or just having to just make your peace with not being.
And it's also just brilliant.
Yeah, you know? It's a brilliant song.
And talking of people who are seen as boy bands, my other contender for the number three spot was Patience by Take That. Because again, you know, Robbie had gone, you know, the career, surely their career is over. They come back with Patience, they follow up with Shine. So you're like, that's the way to come back. And they're still with us now because of that, because they went away. They wrote a load of amazing songs.
Yeah.
So back they come. So take any one of those as your number three. Number two, this is 6 months after. I'm going to talk about Cher.
Okay. I really wanted you because you said you were going to talk about British people, and I was like, what?
Well, then how are we not going to singles, get to Cher? I think. No, we are, of course, I'm going to talk about Cher. 6 months after, she has a number 23 hit in the UK charts with a cover version of I Got You, Babe, which is Cher with Beavis and Butthead.
Oh, my God.
Rob Dickens at her record label is looking around for songs for her 22nd studio album. And there's a song that's been kicking around for a while called Believe. And lots of people like the chorus. They offered it to Saint Etienne, and Saint Etienne said no. They said, everyone who's offered it said, I like the chorus, I don't really like the verses.
That's fun. I didn't know they offered it to Saint Etienne. Yeah. I can slightly imagine her doing it.
Yeah, you can.
In her own very distinctive way.
They do a good version. I think it'd probably be quite hard to do a bad version of Believe, the final version. So Rob Dickens then sends it out to some other songwriters, and they write completely new verses. And it goes to Cher, and Cher hears it. Cher, like everyone says, oh, I love the chorus. That's pretty good. She said, like, you know, I like the first verse, but the second verse, this woman is still whining. So Cher goes, let me rewrite the second verse. Here she writes it as a much more positive thing. Doesn't get a writer's credit, by the way. But even to this day, she said, oh, it's the biggest regret of my career. I should have just said. So she rewrites that. They go into a studio and do it. Again, it's, you know, Cher's Cher, but she hasn't sort of had a huge hit for a very, very long time. And
she has actually, though, had one previous comeback.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because there is a long period away between the whole Sonny and Cher business and her being up on the USS Missouri in a thong singing If I Could Turn Back Time.
Exactly. Listen, she's had many comebacks, Cher, but I'm talking about just... she always will. She's probably having one as we speak. So she goes into the studio, they record this song, the producers do that vocal effect, which is, they said was a vocoder, but it wasn't. It was actually auto-tune, they didn't want to admit that auto-tune existed at that point. So they were still saying, oh no, that's a vocoder. But auto-tune actually has a share effect button now. So she goes in, she records that song. It is one of the 20 top-selling singles of all time, absolutely relaunches Cher everywhere. She doesn't have to do a follow-up to her cover versions with Beavis and Butthead. Sold 11 million records, Believe, by Cher, and all for a song that Saint Etienne turned down and that they had to completely rewrite the whole thing. But that's why, you know, that's the thing about music. Again, just that little piece of a bottled lightning. Number one.
I was going to say, what's number one then?
Number one is a guy who was about to be dropped by his record label, a guy whom there was a huge amount of hype over and a huge amount of, okay, this is going to be our next huge worldwide star. His record company put a huge amount of money behind him. Started off with a cover version of a George Michael song, Freedom. It's Robbie Williams we're talking about. He then releases three tracks off his first album. So he released Old Before I Die, Lazy Days, and South of the Border. None of these are huge hits.
No.
And South of the Border, that's number 14, which back in those days might as well be number 108.
Yeah.
The record company is thinking, oh my God, have we backed the wrong horse here? Yeah. When Take That split up, should we have backed Gary? And everyone's thinking this is the end for Robbie. There's absolutely, you know, and also people are not sad about it because, you know, Robbie's arrogance works when he's successful.
Yeah.
When he was unsuccessful, it looks like arrogance. When he's successful,
it's incredibly embarrassing. Exactly.
There's nothing worse than unsuccessful charisma.
Yeah.
And which is where he was going into charisma deficit at that point. So the record company are thinking, oh my God, what do we do here? This was good. This was our big, big swing. We were thinking, this is a guy who, if everything goes right, if absolutely everything goes right, this guy could sell 50 million records.
They want him to be. It's so explicit, the choice of that George Michael song, which is just like, hey, he used to be in a boy band, right?
And do you then remember?
Like Wham! And then he becomes the most credible recording artist.
Do you remember?
Artist.
Like George Michael?
Yeah.
And so fourth singles off albums are generally not the best singles. You know, if you're Michael Jackson, you can get away with it. But if this is a failing album and you're releasing your fourth single, it's not great. So they release a single, it only gets to number four. But it's Angels.
It never made any sense to me, that, because I just still don't understand why you can't see that that's a massive trap. I'm sorry, I would have not released the others beforehand. But
my view,
and
I do not have insider knowledge of it, is Robbie probably chose, he probably had the power to choose which songs that he wanted to release. And he probably felt that was a bit MOR, a little bit. He wanted to go, no, I'm cool. Probably Freedom, he's thinking, he's aware that's a George Michael track.
Yeah. Oh, he's,
and he's thinking, come on, you know, I want to be my own artist. So he's releasing songs that he thinks are cool. So he's doing Old Before I Die, Lazy Days, and South of the Border. South of the Border is a good song. So he's probably thinking, I don't really want to release that big ballad. And if they release that big ballad,
and
as
they're,
I say,
like, now you work for us.
Yeah, never went to number one. But immediately the album goes to number one. It'd been out for 27 weeks at that point and had not troubled the top of the charts. Suddenly it does trouble the top of the charts, and they do not sell 50 million records for this guy. They sell over 80 million records off the back of Angels being a hit. And if it hadn't been a hit, absolutely he would have been dropped. So I think that is the biggest ever comeback single.
Okay.
Agree? Disagree?
I think,
or do you prefer Cher?
I don't know because Cher
would have made it. I think Cher definitely would have come back at some point with something.
Oh, she's a survivor, Richard.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I thought Robbie just edged
it. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I defer.
Should we do some adverts? Then we'll get on to TV,
books.
I've got a little coda on comedy.
Oh,
as
yes,
well.
Please. Okay, very good.
Welcome back, everybody. Marina, television, biggest ever comeback.
Biggest ever comebacks. Okay, I thought a lot about this, and this person I'm sort of going to just use as an example of quite what happened with quite a few people, but she was particular. So at number three, I would say Paula Abdul in American Idol. She was.
I was not expecting you to say the words Paula Abdul.
No, but
yeah,
but there's
get it.
Something
I get
about
it. Yeah.
She obviously had a. It's weird because she obviously had a big music career. But she had completely fallen away.
Yeah.
And the way Simon Cowell selected the judges for those shows, the way he saw something about her, and let's be honest, it was that she was slightly nuts. She was, but to sort of pull her back out of nowhere and give her that job, and no one really knew what these judging shows were at all. And it became so completely massive. It was the number one show by far in America. And Paula Abdul, who had just been on the scrap heap, really, was suddenly bringing her particular brand of cray cray. And because you're taking her from one genre and putting her another and saying, anyone can do these things now, anyone. And it was a time where you're just thinking, oh, TV's totally different now, and reality TV and all the things we know about, like, what makes a sort of good presenter, and all of those things were slightly going out of the window, and we were seeing a different thing. So I'd say that was big. Now, you'll probably find this ridiculous, but sharing number two.
Yeah.
I have
sharing number two.
Sharing position. You I don't care.
Well, then
I'm
number
doing
three
it.
Is number four.
Well, fine.
So Paula Abdul is number four.
Okay, Paula Abdul's number four.
Oh my God, you're doing a top four.
Yeah.
Okay, great. sorry, is this the biggest ever list?
Listen to me. It is.
Is that what you say now? Is that what you say?
Larry Hagman as JR.
Oh, great.
And in Dallas.
Yeah.
And Joan Collins as Alexis, Colby and Dynasty.
Really good.
Because those things, okay, Larry Hagman had like I Dream of Jeannie, which was that, you know, one of those kind of, but it wasn't that, it was not that big rating, but he was quite well known.
Like a big, that was a sitcom
late
in the States. 60s
supernatural things, a bit like Bewitched or any, you know, Unmarried in Martian or anything like that. But he has a pretty, you know, non-existent 1970s until he is cast as J.R. Ewing in something that no one's sure is going to work at all. And it's just, you know, and it obviously becomes absolutely massive. And he is the biggest thing in it. And the whole plot line about who shot him. It's very hard to explain to people who weren't there just how big those soap operas were.
And who shot J.R. was enormous.
Who shot J.R. was the most enormous thing.
If you thought who voted for Joe Marler was a big one.
Oh, yeah.
Then who shot J.R.
It doesn't even come close.
Yeah.
Okay, and the next one is Joan Collins, because she started as a, you know, with the Rank Film Organisation, she started as a sort of starlet. And then even the 60s, really, much of a desert. The 70s, there's this kind of idea that there are these new genres kind of struggling to be born, the bonkbusters and things like that. So she's in The Stud and The Bitch, and they're huge. But then she goes absolutely stratospheric as Alexis Colby in Dynasty, and she becomes such a huge international star. The plot line of Who Shot JR is enormous, but she is the biggest star. And she really, I mean, that's a comeback, an extraordinary comeback when you think of her being like a starlet in the 50s. It really is absolutely enormous.
Yeah, and it's interesting, some of these comebacks where there is always that seed of what they are to become in these massive comebacks. You know, so Joan Collins had all of that stuff in her. Just she had not had that amazing lightning rod to bring it all out in front of a new public. And, you know, when suddenly the right person gets the right role or releases the right song at the right time, then everything just blossoms.
You're so right. It's like magic in a bottle. It's just something about it. But now, as you can see, I've thought of my actual number one on the hoof. Actual number one has to be... I'm sorry. My actual number one has to be who had fiddled around and had done various television documentaries and was kind of a media star, but then it all falls apart. But then he comes back as the host of a US reality show that becomes the biggest reality show, which is called The Apprentice. And I'm sorry if you don't think that that is surely the biggest. I realised while I was talking about Paula Abdul. Oh my God, I know someone who's a bit bigger than Paula Abdul now.
Not much.
Right? So that has to be surely the biggest ever comeback, because nobody knew or cared, like kind of like an 80s personality and a big thing in the 80s, and then it all falls apart. And then to come back in the 2000s and be the biggest reality star of that era, I think actually bigger than Cal, although Cal was very, very big. I think he'd have to be number two of that. And then, you know, he's gone on to do some other stuff too. So I have to put Donald Trump as my biggest ever TV comeback.
Wow.
I think realistically. Yes. And I only realised it while I was talking.
That's why you're Britain's greatest journalist. I'm going to talk about books.
If only, yes, please.
Three very different types of comebacks here. The first one I'm going to talk about is Donna Tartt. So I loved... Donna Tartt writes a book every 10 years.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I got to tell you.
You'll be living your best life one day.
No, because what are you doing the rest of the time?
I
presume she does stuff. But but it doesn't... That's like... Essentially, she's writing a paragraph a day. Okay. Wow. Anyway, so...
Hey, listen, they're good.
Yeah. Listen.
Nice paragraph.
It's working, Donna. So Secret History comes out in 1992, one of the greatest novels of all time. I think very, very, very hard to follow that up.
And a complete cultural vibe moment. Books opened in the 90s, like mega, mega, mega TV series open now. Like, and then if they take off, everyone's talking about them. That's what 90s books was like.
And that's a great book. Also, if you've got older teens as well, it's an absolutely great book for... them to read. I know it's sort of a museum piece now, but it's so beautifully written. It's you know, it's a museum piece, like Middlemarch is a museum piece. So, you know, it's great. So 10 years later, she brings out The Little Friend, which is sort of a disappointment, I would say. I think it wouldn't have been a disappointment if she brought it out 2 years later.
Yes.
But when it's 10 years later and you're thinking, well, you've only done a paragraph a day for the last 10 years, so this is going to be spectacular. And it has slightly fallen off. So 10 years on from that, she brings out another novel. And that's the point where people think, it's been 20 years now since The Secret History. You've got to write a good one. And she writes The Goldfinch, which I think is better than The Secret History. Yeah. So I think it's a wonderful book. Some people disagree. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. So I think somebody who had started an absolute, you know, just you can't, it's hard to start your literary career in a more spectacular way than The Secret History. 20 years later, the pressure on her for that, and that could have been the end of everything, but no. The Goldfinch, I think I'm going to put that number three, greatest ever book comebacks. Number two, I am going to talk about one of the loveliest men in all of literature, Mick Herron. So Mick Herron in 2003 writes a book called Down Cemetery Road about a private investigator. It doesn't really trouble the scorers. He does a few more. No one is buying these books. And this is an incredibly familiar story for an awful lot of writers. So people, you know, they're publishing more of them because people can read that he's great. You know, his publishers know that he's great. So he thinks, oh, okay. And he works at Incomes Data Services. He's sub-editing the employment law brief. That is Mick's day job all the way up to 2017, by the way. Probably our finest contemporary writer. But
yeah.
So 2010, he's thinks, okay, I'm going to move in a slightly different direction. I'm going to write like a spy type thing, but I want it to be funny. So he writes Slow Horses, which of course now we know as this huge runaway hit and everyone absolutely adores it. Writes Slow Horses, nobody really reads it. I mean, you can read it now, you'll see what a brilliant book it is. And he writes the follow-up to Slow Horses, which is called Dead Lions. And his publisher, Constable, reads it, says, sorry, Mick, not for us. I'm afraid this is, it's not going to happen. You know, you've written these four books in the other series. Now we've got this, you know, we've seen Slow Horses. We've given you a go with that. It's just, it's not for us. So his agent takes it around to various other publishers and they all go, well, it's a sort of follow-up to something that another publisher released. I don't know what we would really do with it. And also, it's what is it? Is it a thriller? Is it funny? I mean, I don't really know what this is. The tone, Mick, with respect, is absolutely all over the place. You know, I can't see a world in which people are going to love this. So Mick returns back to his day job thinking, oh, my God. An American publisher, Soho Press, says, we love Slow Horses. We will publish two more. So they said, we will take Dead Lions and they'll also take Real Tigers, which was the next one. And so he's still writing. There's still money coming in. But again, there's not sales coming in. 2015, John Murray, which is a different publisher. Because see, that's the thing, is all these books were brilliant.
Yeah.
And anyone with a proper eye can see that they're brilliant. And this is no shade on Constable, his publisher, by the way. You can't keep throwing money at something if you're not selling it. So they could know it's good, but they think there's not a lot we can do. John Murray say, look, we must be able to reissue these and do something with them because they're so great. Again, not really. You know, nothing was really happening. 2017, Waterstones pick Slow Horses as their thriller of the month. Now, this is a book that was written 7 years ago and that no one really wanted to buy the follow-up from. But over the years, you know, enough people have liked it. They pick up that book, 2017, suddenly
it becomes
a hit.
Does someone just reads it and thinks, this is great,
yeah,
everyone should know about this? And because they have the power within the organisation, they just say, please let...
And the same thing, by the way, was happening in America, like NPR, the public radio, which is a big deal for books over there. One of their presenters had picked up Slow Horses as well and was like, everyone, you have got to buy this book and read this book. And there are lots of books, by the way, that don't have this, just, it's a, you know, you need a little bit of fortune along the way as well. But the truth is, Mick was always an amazing writer. So everyone who picked up these books would have the same response, which is, sorry, why is everybody not reading?
And were there, so there are a couple more by that point, so you can already get on into...
Exactly. So Mick's got all his back catalogue and, you know, just continues writing, gives up his job, as I say, in 2017, which is the same year as that Waterstones make him the thriller of the month. And you go all the way back to 2003, that Down Cemetery Road, and that's now on Apple TV with Emma Thompson and Ruth Wilson playing the main parts. So Mick Herron, who... also is just one of the nicest men you'll ever meet and one of the most talented men you'll ever meet. But how about that from a comeback from his publisher saying, I'm sorry.
That was more than on the ropes. That's really on the floor.
No more of these books to being one of the best-selling authors in the UK and America. But my number one in book comebacks is a character.
Oh, really? I thought you were going to say one day. Okay.
You tell me what you thought afterwards.
Okay.
1887. Arthur Conan Doyle releases A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel. Mere 6 years later, he's only written two novels, but lots of short stories as well. So, and the public has gone crazy for Sherlock Holmes. They love Sherlock Holmes. Strand magazine that it's published in, it's just, you know, it boosts their circulation by so much. Arthur Conan Doyle thought of himself, he only sort of dipped into detective fiction because it started becoming fashionable. He thought, I reckon I could do an English version of this. And so done these Sherlock Holmes things, but he saw himself as an historical novelist, really. He said that Sherlock Holmes was sort of taking away from, you know, the real work of his life, which are these historical novels, which have been lost to time. And so 6 years after the very first appearance, Arthur Conan Doyle goes, I'm going to kill him off. So he kills him off in a short story called The Final Problem. He goes over the Reichenbach Falls with Andrew Scott, I think.
You've spoilt the Reichenbach Falls.
I can't believe you spoiled Andrew Scott. And refuses to write another one for 10 years, just won't do it. And the Strand magazine says, oh, we'll give you literally any money you want. He goes, no, I'm not going to do it. It's the first real example of like fandom. And, you know, all these groups that were around Sherlock Holmes, who loved Sherlock Holmes and, you know, were incredibly angry that there was no more Sherlock Holmes. So 10 years later, he had genuinely had no desire ever to write another word of Sherlock Holmes. 10 years later, finally gives in and writes The Hound of the Baskervilles. And Sherlock Holmes is now the fictional character who's appeared on screen more than any other in the entirety of cultural history. And for 10 years, he was dead. And then Arthur Conan Doyle, for reasons best known to himself, I imagine a tax bill, thinks I'm going to bring him back. So I think Sherlock Holmes has to be the greatest comeback in literary history.
That is very... Okay, I agree with you. I agree with you. The person I was going to mention wasn't a character, and I think a character is much better, was George R.R. Martin, because he starts as a sort of science fiction and a horror writer to some extent, and he has like some success, and he does, you know, he makes it a career to some extent. But then he goes to Hollywood or to television and becomes a TV producer and TV writer and all of those things. And I think there's 12 or 13 years since he's published a book. And during that time, he thought, I actually want to do something totally different. I don't think I'm not really going to do science fiction to some extent, although there may be supernatural elements in it. And he comes back with A Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty, because he's in another career by this point.
Yeah.
And he's, so I think, but it's not the same as Sherlock
Holmes. Yeah, it didn't
Holmes,
quite so. Fit my no. idea of a comeback in that way.
I agree.
I didn't realise until recently that Game of Thrones is a pun on the, it's based on the Tom Daly knitting show on Channel 4, A Game of Wool.
A Game of Wool, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's better.
It's based on that,
A Game
yeah.
of Wool. It really works as a title,
so I think George
R.R.
Martin had obviously watched A Game of Wool. I thought, hold on a minute. This is about Thrones, A Game of Thrones.
Okay, that's a good one. There's one.
This is fun, by the way.
I really like this.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of biggest ever impact, these are the ones. Can I just give you a couple that I felt like couldn't specifically fit into any?
Oh, so you're going to do like a
just
kind of
like
sweep
a little,
up category?
Well, yeah, sort of. Because,
and then I'm going to mention one person, person who I think has had the greatest comeback in British entertainment history.
Okay, good.
That's where I'm
All
ending.
Right. The ones that I was going to mention was, I would say that when 20th Century Fox buys Star Wars, they are in so much financial trouble that they are basically, people think they're going to fold. And this kind of weird space opera becomes, it's so enormous to that company that even in that money, it earns something like 100 million in the first few months. They are buying all forms of other companies. They essentially become a conglomerate because of this film. And the share price is absolutely tanking, and it's down at six, and it goes up to something like $25 within 3 months, all because of this film. So I would say that is a kind of amazing story, because that could have completely folded. The other person I find absolutely fascinating in terms of like two halves is Lucille Ball, because she was this huge television star, and obviously she, and her life story is absolutely amazing. There's some great books about her, but she kind of leads everything with I Love Lucy for as long as it's on television, and she's married to Desi Arnaz Jr. and they have a production company which ends up sort of producing her shows called Desilu, and then they divorce. And she buys him out of Desilu, and she becomes a television producer. And she is an extraordinarily adventurous and committed television. Eventually, by the way, Desilu is sold to Garth and Weston, and it becomes Paramount TV.
Oh, wow.
It's built. Yeah. But can I tell you the shows that she personally said, I think we should go ahead with these? A little show called Star Trek.
Okay.
She's the EP on all of these, but they're all Desilu shows. Mission Impossible.
Wow.
The Untouchables. And all of these shows, which are huge, kind of, I mean, you know, they're still IP that we talk about and that people endlessly remake. Star Trek particularly is such a weird punt, and she takes it. It's more of a second act in some ways than a comeback, I suppose. But in terms of how difficult it was when her marriage ended, she had this company, and rather than sort of giving it up, she just revolutionises her role within it. And instead of always being the star, she becomes this producer.
She's going to use this power that I've got.
And I just think Lucille Ball's amazing, so right. I have to have her in my biggest ever comebacks just because.
So Star Wars and Lucille Ball.
Okay. Tell me.
Well, no, I was thinking about Bob Monkhouse, firstly, because Bob Monkhouse, who was a comedian, obviously, an actor, joke writer, and had got into a sort of rut of hosting game shows.
Yeah.
Bob's Full House, all sorts of different things, which he was very good at, but he sort of became slightly wiped clean. There was one, you know, he was doing a lot of them a day. He could do them very easily. You watch Bob's Full House, and the first 14 minutes of him doing a monologue to a non-existent audience, literally to a floor manager and some camera operators. And so...
What a pro.
What a pro. But I think a generation grew up thinking that there was some smarm to Bob Monkhouse.
Yeah.
And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, proper comics started to really look at what it was he was doing and started going, he's not what we think he is. No. This guy's really writing his own stuff. The stuff is great. There's some amazing material.
And it's really odd and subversive in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
But people just felt, because of the game show grin and the suit,
yeah.
Oh, I don't want to get, but it wasn't at all.
And he's got that real, you know, he's taken his look from, you know, American TV of the 60s and 70s. So, you know, which is that very, very polished. And it just, when you first look at him, people were turned off him slightly. But the comedy community worked out just in time. It turned out that actually this guy was one of the greats. And there's an amazing documentary you can watch called Bob Monkhouse, The Last Stand from 2003, where he does a gig at the Albany Comedy Club, a small little gig, and invites an audience of young comics to come and watch him do this amazing set of just great, great, great jokes. And it's the last thing you'll ever see of him, because he died a few months later, prostate cancer. And how lovely, though, that at least he had had that comeback, that he'd been turned from a figure of you know, that was unfair to what it was, to, and the comedy community goes, no, this guy's the real deal. Anyway, so I was thinking about Bob Monkhouse, and that's a great comeback. But I think, I just want to do something that's very, very current. So I'm thinking about, it's 2013, I think, we're on Series 7, Episode 6 of Would I Lie to You? And it's the first time I've ever done it. I love Would I Lie to You, so I'm on Would I Lie to You, and I think, oh, great. And it was also the first ever appearance of Bob Mortimer. And Bob, it's easy to forget that in 2013, so Vic and Bob have been absolutely massive, and Shooting Stars have been absolutely massive, and they'd done things like Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, and they'd done, like, Catterick, which is a crazy sitcom. Yeah. So he was always around and about and doing things. But I think he was at the stage where Vic had started doing his own things. Bob was sort of doing his own things. He'd done his own panel show called 29 Minutes of Fame on the BBC, which hadn't really done anything. Vic and Bob had teamed up again to do House of Fools, which is another sitcom. And he was in danger sort of floating through British culture.
Well, people liked him. He still loved, but a legacy person.
Exactly. And you go, Vic and Vic without Bob and Bob without Vic, is this, maybe this isn't going to work. And Rachel Ablett, who's the producer of Would I Lie to You, says that even now, she said, I remember talking to him and saying, you should come and do Would I Lie to You. And Bob said, I don't think I'd be very good. And he went on and did that. He said since, this is the show that's had the most impact of anything I've ever done.
On his career.
In my whole career. And from that moment, bit by bit by bit, I would argue that he is, in 2025, our greatest entertainment national treasure.
He's bigger than he's ever been.
His appearances on that show are huge. His appearances on Last One Laughing were absolutely massive. People are absolutely fuming that he hasn't been on Celebrity Traitors yet. His appearance on Taskmaster was absolutely huge. His books are amazing. Everything
fishing.
He does. Exactly. White House and Mortimer Go Fishing. Everything he does
as an author, as you say,
is sensational.
Yeah,
but in 2013, genuinely, he's in one of those positions, and it happens to lots of stars where they're like, I don't know the thing to do next. What's it? I don't know. The British public don't quite know how to define me, because people didn't know what it was that he could do and who he was.
Turns out, almost everything.
Turns out, yeah, exactly everything. You know, they were used to seeing him as something else.
Yeah.
So I genuinely think that decision he made to Do What I Lie To You. On that very first episode is the one where he says that he can tear an apple apart with his hands. No spoilers. I wonder if he can. And from that moment on, I think that was the beginning of him becoming our current greatest national treasure.
Biggest and most heartwarming ever comeback. There's not a single person in this nation who would begrudge him it.
Yeah, and the loveliest man.
Yeah.
The loveliest man. That was really, really good fun.
That was great fun. I enjoyed that very much.
Our biggest ever comebacks. If you have opinions on those, do please tell us as well. We'd love to hear you, because we must have missed people out.
I know I will have.
For definite. But, we should do more of this sort of
It's a good
thing.
Subject.
Yeah, exactly. Not comebacks, but we'll do something else.
Yeah.
But it's fun to do lists every now and again.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Don't forget, we have a bonus episode tomorrow. If you want to sign up for ad-free listening and bonus episodes, it is therestisentertainment.com.
It is.
God, I always get that wrong.
Yep, you got it right today.
And thank you to People's Postcode Lottery. They're about to do their biggest ever prize pot. Thank you for suggesting this idea to us.